Conclusion: the results of the labor performed by this generation are divisible into two classes, between which it is important clearly to distinguish. The first class includes the products of the soil which belong to this first generation in its usufructuary capacity, augmented, improved and refined by its labor and industry. These products consist either of objects of consumption or instruments of labor. It is clear that these products are the legitimate property of those who have created them by their activity. Second class, not only has this generation created the products just mentioned, objects of consumption and instruments of labor, but it has also added to the original value of the soil by cultivation, by the erection of buildings, by all the labor-producing permanent results which it has performed. This additional value evidently constitutes a product A value created by the activity of the first generation, and if, by any means whatever, the ownership of this value be distributed among the members of society equitably, that is, in proportion to the labor which each has performed, each will legitimately possess the portion which he receives. He may then dispose of this legitimate and private property as he sees fit, exchange it, give it away, or transfer it, and no other individual, or collection of other individuals, that is, society, can lay any claim to these values. Thus, by the distribution of collective capital, to the use of which each associate, either in his own right or in right of his authors, has an imprescriptible and undivided title, there will be in the phalanstery, as in the France of 1841, the poor and the rich. Some men who, to live in luxury, have only, as Figaro says, to take the trouble to be born. And others for whom the fortune of life is but an opportunity for long-continued poverty. Idlers with large incomes. And workers whose fortune is always in the future. Some privileged by birth and caste. And others pariahs whose sole civil and political rights are the right to labor and the right to land. For we must not be deceived. In the phalanstery everything will be as it is today, an object of property, machines, inventions, thought, books, the products of art, of agriculture, and of industry, animals, houses, fences, vineyards, pastures, forests, fields, everything, in short, except the uncultivated land. Now, would you like to know what uncultivated land is worth, according to the advocates of property? A square league hardly suffices for the support of a savage, says M. Charles Comte. Estimating the wretched subsistence of this savage at 300 francs per year, we find that the square league necessary to his life is, relatively to him, faithfully represented by a rent of 15 francs. In France there are 28,000 square leagues, the total rent of which, by this estimate, would be 420,000 francs, which, when divided among nearly 34 millions of people, would give each an income of a centime and a quarter. That is the new right which the great genius of Feuillet has invented in behalf of the French people, and with which his first disciple hopes to reform the world. I denounce M. Considerant to the proletariat. If the theory of M. Considerant would at least really guarantee this property which he cherishes so jealously, I might pardon him the flaws in his syllogism, certainly the best one he ever made in his life. But, no, that which M. Considerant takes for property is only a privilege of extra pay. In Feuillet's system, neither the created capital nor the increased value of the soil are divided and appropriated in any effective manner. The instruments of labor, whether created or not, remain in the hands of the phalanx. The pretended proprietor can touch only the income. He is permitted neither to realize his share of the stock, nor to possess it exclusively, nor to administer it, whatever it be. The cashier throws him his dividend, and then, proprietor, eat the whole if you can. The system of Feuillet would not suit the proprietors, since it takes away the most delightful feature of property, the free disposition of one's goods. It would please the communists no better, since it involves unequal conditions. It is repugnant to the friends of free association and equality, in consequence of its tendency to wipe out human character and individuality by suppressing possession, family, and country, the threefold expression of the human personality. Of all our active publicists, none seem to me more fertile in resources, richer in imagination, more luxuriant and varied in style, than M. Considerant. Nevertheless, I doubt if he will undertake to re-establish his theory of property. If he has this courage, this is what I would say to him. Before writing your reply, consider well your plan of action. Do not scour the country, have recourse to none of your ordinary expedients, no complaints of civilization, no sarcasms upon equality, no glorification of the phalanstery. Leave Freya and the departed in peace, and endeavor only to readjust the pieces of your syllogism. To this end, you ought, first, to analyze closely each proposition of your adversary, second, to show the error, either by a direct refutation or by proving the converse, third, to oppose argument to argument, so that, objection and reply meeting face to face, the stronger may break down the weaker and shiver it to atoms. By that method only can you boast of having conquered, and compel me to regard you as an honest reasoner and a good artillery man. I should have no excuse for tarrying longer with these phalansterian crotchets, if the obligation which I have imposed upon myself of making a clean sweep, and the necessity of vindicating my dignity as a writer, did not prevent me from passing in silence the reproach uttered against me by a correspondent of La Phalange. We have seen but lately, says this journalist, that M. Proudhon, enthusiast as he has been for the science created by Freya, is, or will be, an enthusiast for anything else whatsoever. If ever sectarians had the right to reproach another for changes in his beliefs, this right certainly does not belong to the disciples of Freya, who are always so eager to administer the phalansterian baptism to the deserters of all parties. But why regard it as a crime, if they are sincere? Of what consequence is the constancy or inconstancy of an individual to the truth which is always the same? It is better to enlighten men's minds than to teach them to be obstinate in their prejudices. Do we not know that man is frail and fickle, that his heart is full of delusions, and that his lips are a distillery of falsehood? Omnis homo mudax. Whether we will or no, we all serve for a time as instruments of this truth, whose kingdom comes every day. God alone is immutable, because he is eternal. That is the reply which, as a general rule, an honest man is entitled always to make, and which I ought perhaps to be content to offer as an excuse, for I am no better than my fathers. But in a century of doubt and apostasy like ours, when it is of importance to set the small and the weak an example of strength and honesty of utterance, I must not suffer my character as a public assailant of property to be dishonored. I must render an account of my old opinions. Examining myself, therefore, upon this charge of Fourierism, and endeavoring to refresh my memory, I find that, having been connected with the Fourierists in my studies and my friendships, it is possible that, without knowing it, I have been one of Fourier's partisans. Jerome Lallon placed Napoleon and Jesus Christ in his catalogue of atheists. The Fourierists resemble this astronomer. If a man happens to find fault with the existing civilization, and to admit the truth of a few of their criticisms, they straightway enlist him, willy-nilly, in their school. Nevertheless, I do not deny that I have been a Fourierist, for, since they say it, of course it may be so. But, sir, that of which my ex-associates are ignorant, and which doubtless will astonish you, is that I have been many other things, in religion, by turns a Protestant, Papist, an Arian and Semi-Arian, a Manichaean, a Gnostic, an Adamite even and a Pre-Adamite, a Skeptic, a Pelagian, Socinian, an Anti-Trinitarian, and a Neo-Christian. In philosophy and politics, an idealist, a pantheist, a Platonist, a Cartesian, an eclectic, that is, a sort of just milieu, a monarchist, an aristocrat, a constitutionalist, a follower of Babeuf, and a communist. I have wandered through a whole encyclopedia of systems. Do you think it surprising, sir, that, among them all, I was for a short time a Fourierist? For my part, I am not at all surprised, although at present I have no recollection of it. One thing is sure, that my superstition and credulity reached their height at the very period of my life which my critics reproachfully assign as the date of my Fourieristic beliefs. Now I hold quite other views. My mind no longer admits that which is demonstrated by syllogisms, analogies, or metaphors, which are the methods of the phalanstery, that demands a process of generalization and induction which excludes error. Of my past opinions, I retain absolutely none. I have acquired some knowledge. I no longer believe. I either know or am ignorant. In a word, in seeking for the reason of things, I saw that I was a rationalist. Undoubtedly, it would have been simpler to begin where I have ended. But then, if such is the law of the human mind, if all society, for 6,000 years, has done nothing but fall into error, if all mankind are still buried in the darkness of faith, deceived by their prejudices and passions, guided only by the instinct of their leaders, if my accusers, themselves, are not free from sectarianism, for they call themselves Fouriers, am I alone inexcusable for having, in my inner self, at the secret tribunal of my conscience, begun anew the journey of our poor humanity? I would by no means, then, deny my errors. But, sir, that which distinguishes me from those who rush into print is the fact that, though my thoughts have varied much, my writings do not vary. Today, even, and on a multitude of questions, I am beset by a thousand extravagant and contradictory opinions, but my opinions I do not print, for the public has nothing to do with them. Before addressing my fellow men, I wait until light breaks in upon the chaos of my ideas, in order that what I may say may be, not the whole truth, no man can know that, but nothing but the truth. This singular disposition of my mind to first identify itself with a system in order to better understand it, and then to reflect upon it in order to test its legitimacy, is the very thing which disgusted me with Fourier, and ruined in my esteem the societary school. To be a faithful Fourierist, in fact, one must abandon his reason and accept everything from a master, doctrine, interpretation, and application. M. Considerant, whose excessive intolerance anathematizes all who do not abide by his sovereign decisions, has no other conception of Fourierism. Has he not been appointed Fourier's vicar on earth and pope of a church which, unfortunately for its apostles, will never be of this world? Passive belief is the theological virtue of all sectarians, especially of the Fourierists. Now, this is what happened to me. While trying to demonstrate by argument the religion of which I had become a follower in studying Fourier, I suddenly perceived that by reasoning I was becoming incredulous, that on each article of the creed my reason and my faith were at variance, and that my 6 weeks' labor was wholly lost. I saw that the Fourierists, in spite of their inexhaustible gabble and their extravagant pretension to decide in all things, were neither savants, nor logicians, nor even believers, that they were scientific quacks, who were led more by their self-love than their conscience to labor for the triumph of their sect, and to whom all means were good that would reach that end. I then understood why to the Epicureans they promised women, wine, music, and a sea of luxury, to the rigorists, maintenance of marriage, purity of morals, and temperance, to laborious, high wages, to proprietors, large incomes, to philosophers, solutions the secret of which Fourier alone possessed, to priests, a costly religion and magnificent festivals, to savants, knowledge of an unimaginable nature, to each, indeed, that which he most desired. In the beginning, this seemed to me droll; in the end, I regarded it as the height of impudence. No, sir, no one yet knows of the foolishness and infamy which the phalansterian system contains. That is a subject which I mean to treat as soon as I have balanced my accounts with property. It is rumored that the Fourierists think of leaving France and going to the New World to found a phalanstery. When a house threatens to fall, the rats scamper away. That is because they are rats. Men do better, they rebuild it. Not long since, the Saint Simonians, despairing of their country which paid no heed to them, proudly shook the dust from their feet and started for the Orient to fight the battle of free woman. Pride, willfulness, mad selfishness. True charity, like true faith, does not worry, never despairs. It seeks neither its own glory, nor its interest, nor empire. It does everything for all, speaks with indulgence to the reason and the will, and desires to conquer only by persuasion and sacrifice. Remain in France, Fourierists, if the progress of humanity is the only thing which you have at heart. There is more to do here than in the New World. Otherwise, go. You are nothing but liars and hypocrites. The foregoing statement by no means embraces all the political elements, all the opinions and tendencies which threaten the future of property, but it ought to satisfy anyone who knows how to classify facts and to deduce their law or the idea which governs them. Existing society seems abandoned to the demon of falsehood and discord, and it is this sad sight which grieves so deeply many distinguished minds who lived too long in a former age to be able to understand ours. Now, while the short-sighted spectator begins to despair of humanity, and, distracted and cursing that of which he is ignorant, plunges into skepticism and fatalism, the true observer, certain of the spirit which governs the world, seeks to comprehend and fathom providence. The memoir on property, published last year by the pensioner of the Academy of Bisankan, is simply a study of this nature. The time has come for me to relate the history of this unlucky treatise, which has already caused me so much chagrin and made me so unpopular, but which was on my part so involuntary and unpremeditated, that I would dare to affirm that there is not an economist, not a philosopher, not a jurist, who is not 100 times guiltier than I. There is something so singular in the way in which I was led to attack property, that if, on hearing my sad story, you persist, sir, in your blame, I hope at least you will be forced to pity me. I never have pretended to be a great politician, far from that, I always have felt for controversies of a political nature the greatest aversion, and if, in my essay on property, I have sometimes ridiculed our politicians, believe, sir, that I was governed much less by my pride in the little that I know, than by my vivid consciousness of their ignorance and excessive vanity. Relying more on providence than on men, not suspecting at first that politics, like every other science, contained an absolute truth, agreeing equally well with Bossuet and Jean-Jacques, I accepted with resignation my share of human misery, and contented myself with praying to God for good deputies, upright ministers, and an honest king. By taste as well as by discretion and lack of confidence in my powers, I was slowly pursuing some commonplace studies in philology, mingled with a little metaphysics, when I suddenly fell upon the greatest problem that ever has occupied philosophical minds, I mean the criterion of certainty. Those of my readers who are unacquainted with the philosophical terminology will be glad to be told in a few words what this criterion is, which plays so great a part in my work. The criterion of certainty, according to the philosophers, will be, when discovered, an infallible method of establishing the truth of an opinion, a judgment, a theory, or a system, in nearly the same way as gold is recognized by the touchstone, as iron approaches the magnet, or, better still, as we verify a mathematical operation by applying the proof. Time has hitherto served as a sort of criterion for society. Thus, the primitive men having observed that they were not all equal in strength, beauty, and labor judged, and rightly, that certain ones among them were called by nature to the performance of simple and common functions. But they concluded, and this is where their error lay, that these same individuals of duller intellect, more restricted genius, and weaker personality, were predestined to serve the others. That is, to labor while the latter rested, and to have no other will than theirs. And from this idea of a natural subordination among men sprang domesticity, which, voluntarily accepted at first, was imperceptibly converted into horrible slavery. Time, making this error more palpable, has brought about justice. Nations have learned at their own cost that the subjection of man to man is a false idea, an erroneous theory, pernicious alike to master and to slave. And yet such a social system has stood several thousand years, and has been defended by celebrated philosophers, even today, under somewhat mitigated forms, sophists of every description uphold and extol it. But experience is bringing it to an end. Time, then, is the criterion of societies. Thus looked at, history is the demonstration of the errors of humanity by the argument reductio ad absurdum. Now, the criterion sought for by metaphysicians would have the advantage of discriminating at once between the true and the false in every opinion, so that in politics, religion, and morals, for example, the true and the useful being immediately recognized, we should no longer need to await the sorrowful experience of time. Evidently such a secret would be death to the sophists, that cursed brood, who, under different names, excite the curiosity of nations, and, owing to the difficulty of separating the truth from the error in their artistically woven theories, lead them into fatal ventures, disturb their peace, and fill them with such extraordinary prejudice. Up to this day, the criterion of certainty remains a mystery. This is owing to the multitude of criteria that have been successively proposed. Some have taken for an absolute and definite criterion the testimony of the senses, others intuition, these evidence, those argument. M. Lemene affirms that there is no other criterion than universal reason. Before him, M. de Bonald thought he had discovered it in language. Quite recently, M. Bouchet has proposed morality, and, to harmonize them all, the eclectics have said that it was absurd to seek for an absolute criterion, since there were as many criteria as special orders of knowledge. Of all these hypotheses, it may be observed that the testimony of the senses is not a criterion, because the senses, relating us only to phenomena, furnish us with no ideas. That intuition needs external confirmation or objective certainty. That evidence requires proof. An argument verification. That universal reason has been wrong many a time. That language serves equally well to express the true or the false. That morality, like all the rest, needs demonstration and rule. And finally, that the eclectic idea is the least reasonable of all, since it is of no use to say that there are several criteria if we cannot point out one. I very much fear that it will be with the criterion as with the philosopher's stone, that it will finally be abandoned, not only as insolvable, but as chimerical. Consequently, I entertain no hopes of having found it. Nevertheless, I am not sure that someone more skillful will not discover it. Be it as it may with regard to a criterion or criteria, there are methods of demonstration which, when applied to certain subjects, may lead to the discovery of unknown truths, bring to light relations hitherto unsuspected, and lift a paradox to the highest degree of certainty. In such a case, it is not by its novelty, nor even by its content, that a system should be judged, but by its method. The critic, then, should follow the example of the Supreme Court, which, in the cases which come before it, never examines the facts, but only the form of procedure. Now, what is the form of procedure? A method. I then look to see what philosophy, in the absence of a criterion, had accomplished by the aid of special methods, and I must say that I could not discover, in spite of the loudly proclaimed pretensions of some, that it had produced anything of real value, and, at last, wearied with the philosophical twaddle, I resolved to make a new search for the criterion. I confess it, to my shame, this folly lasted for 2 years, and I am not yet entirely rid of it. It was like seeking a needle in a haystack. I might have learned Chinese or Arabic in the time that I have lost in considering and reconsidering syllogisms, in rising to the summit of an induction as to the top of a ladder, in inserting a proposition between the horns of a dilemma, in decomposing, distinguishing, separating, denying, affirming, admitting, as if I could pass abstractions through a sieve. I selected justice as the subject matter of my experiments. Finally, after 1,000 decompositions, recompositions, and double compositions, I found at the bottom of my analytical crucible, not the criterion of certainty, but a metaphysico-economico-political treatise, whose conclusions were such that I did not care to present them in a more artistic or, if you will, more intelligible form. The effect which this work produced upon all classes of minds gave me an idea of the spirit of our age, and did not cause me to regret the prudent and scientific obscurity of my style. How happens it that today I am obliged to defend my intentions, when my conduct bears the evident impress of such lofty morality? You have read my work, sir, and you know the gist of my tedious and scholastic lucubrations. Considering the revolutions of humanity, the vicissitudes of empires, the transformations of property, and the innumerable forms of justice and of right, I asked, are the evils which afflict us inherent in our condition as men, or do they arise only from an error? This inequality of fortunes, which all admit to be the cause of society's embarrassments, is it, as some assert, the effect of nature? Or, in the division of the products of labor and the soil, may there not have been some error in calculation? Does each laborer receive all that is due him? And only that which is due him? In short, in the present conditions of labor, wages, an exchange, is no one wronged, the accounts well kept, is the social balance accurate? Then I commenced a most laborious investigation. It was necessary to arrange informal notes, to discuss contradictory titles, to reply to captious allegations, to refute absurd pretensions, and to describe fictitious debts, dishonest transactions, and fraudulent accounts. In order to triumph over quibblers, I had to deny the authority of custom, to examine the arguments of legislators, and to oppose science with science itself. Finally, all these operations completed, I had to give a judicial decision. I therefore declared, my hand upon my heart, before God and men, that the causes of social inequality are three in number: 1. Gratuitous appropriation of collective wealth; 2. Inequality in exchange; 3. The right of profit or increase. And since this threefold method of extortion is the very essence of the domain of property, I denied the legitimacy of property and proclaimed its identity with robbery. That is my only offense. I have reasoned upon property, I have searched for the criterion of justice, I have demonstrated, not the possibility, but the necessity, of equality of fortunes, I have allowed myself no attack upon persons, no assault upon the government, of which I, more than anyone else, am a provisional adherent. If I have sometimes used the word proprietor, I have used it as the abstract name of a metaphysical being, whose reality breathes in every individual, not alone in a privileged few. Nevertheless, I acknowledge, for I wish my confession to be sincere, that the general tone of my book has been bitterly censured. They complain of an atmosphere of passion and invective unworthy of an honest man, and quite out of place in the treatment of so grave a subject. If this reproach is well founded, which it is impossible for me either to deny or admit, because in my own cause I cannot be judge, if, I say, I deserve this charge, I can only humble myself and acknowledge myself guilty of an involuntary wrong, the only excuse that I could offer being of such a nature that it ought not to be communicated to the public. All that I can say is, that I understand better than anyone how the anger which injustice causes may render an author harsh and violent in his criticisms. When, after 20 years of labor, man still finds himself on the brink of starvation, and then suddenly discovers in an equivocation, an error in calculation, the cause of the evil which torments him in common with so many millions of his fellows, he can scarcely restrain a cry of sorrow and dismay. But, sir, though pride be offended by my rudeness, it is not to pride that I apologize, but to the proletaires, to the simple-minded, whom I perhaps have scandalized. My angry dialectics may have produced a bad effect on some peaceable minds. Some poor working man more affected by my sarcasm than by the strength of my arguments may, perhaps, have concluded that property is the result of a perpetual Machiavellianism on the part of the governors against the governed, a deplorable error of which my book itself is the best refutation. I devoted 2 chapters to showing how property springs from human personality and the comparison of individuals. Then I explained its perpetual limitation, and, following out the same idea, I predicted its approaching disappearance. How, then, could the editors of the Revue Démocratique, after having borrowed from me nearly the whole substance of their economical articles, dare to say, the holders of the soil and other productive capital are more or less willful accomplices in a vast robbery, they being the exclusive receivers and sharers of the stolen goods? The proprietors willfully guilty of the crime of robbery. Never did that homicidal phrase escape my pen. Never did my heart conceive the frightful thought. Thank heaven! I know not how to calumniate my kind, and I have too strong a desire to seek for the reason of things to be willing to believe in criminal conspiracies. The millionaire is no more tainted by property than the journeyman who works for 30 sous per day. On both sides the error is equal, as well as the intention. The effect is also the same, though positive in the former and negative in the latter. I accused property, I did not denounce the proprietors, which would have been absurd, and I am sorry that there are among us wills so perverse and minds so shattered that they care for only so much of the truth as will aid them in their evil designs. Such is the only regret which I feel on account of my indignation, which, though expressed perhaps too bitterly, was at least honest and legitimate in its source. However, what did I do in this essay which I voluntarily submitted to the Academy of Moral Sciences? Seeking a fixed axiom amid social uncertainties, I traced back to one fundamental question all the secondary questions over which, at present, so keen and diversified a conflict is raging. This question was the right of property. Then, comparing all existing theories with each other, and extracting from them that which is common to them all, I endeavored to discover that element in the idea of property which is necessary, immutable, and absolute, and asserted, after authentic verification, that this idea is reducible to that of individual and transmissible possession, susceptible of exchange, but not of alienation, founded on labor, and not on fictitious occupancy or idle caprice. I said, further, that this idea was the result of our revolutionary movements, the culminating point towards which all opinions, gradually divesting themselves of their contradictory elements, converge. And I try to demonstrate this by the spirit of the laws, by political economy, by psychology and history. A father of the church, finishing a learned exposition of the Catholic doctrine, cried, in the enthusiasm of his faith, Domine, si erra est, te decepti sumus, if my religion is false, God is to blame. I, as well as this theologian, can say, if equality is a fable, God, through whom we act and think and are, God, who governs society by eternal laws, who rewards just nations, and punishes proprietors, God alone is the author of evil, God has lied. The fault lies not with me. But if I am mistaken in my inferences, I should be shown my error, and led out of it. It is surely worth the trouble, and I think I deserve this honor. There is no ground for prescription. For, in the words of that member of the convention who did not like the guillotine, to kill is not to reply. Until then, I persist in regarding my work as useful, social, full of instruction for public officials, worthy, in short, of reward and encouragement. For there is one truth of which I am profoundly convinced: nations live by absolute ideas, not by approximate and partial conceptions. Therefore, men are needed who define principles, or at least test them in the fire of controversy. Such is the law, the idea first, the pure idea, the understanding of the laws of God, the theory. Practice follows with slow steps, cautious, attentive to the succession of events, sure to seize, towards this eternal meridian, the indications of supreme reason. The cooperation of theory and practice produces in humanity the realization of order, the absolute truth. All of us, as long as we live, called, each in proportion to his strength, to this sublime work. The only duty which it imposes upon us is to refrain from appropriating the truth to ourselves, either by concealing it, or by accommodating it to the temper of the century, or by using it for our own interests. This principle of conscience, so grand and so simple, has always been present in my thought. Consider, in fact, sir, that which I might have done, but did not wish to do. I reason on the most honorable hypothesis. What hindered me from concealing, for some years to come, the abstract theory of the equality of fortunes? And, at the same time, from criticizing constitutions and codes? From showing the absolute and the contingent, the immutable and the ephemeral, the eternal and the transitory, in laws present and past? From constructing a new system of legislation? And establishing on a solid foundation this social edifice, ever destroyed and as often rebuilt? Might I not, taking up the definitions of casuists, have clearly shown the cause of their contradictions and uncertainties, and supplied, at the same time, the inadequacies of their conclusions? Might I not have confirmed this labor by a vast historical exposition, in which the principle of exclusion and of the accumulation of property, the appropriation of collective wealth, and the radical vice in exchanges would have figured as the constant causes of tyranny, war, and revolution? It should have been done, you say. Do not doubt, sir, that such a task would have required more patience than genius. With the principles of social economy which I have analyzed, I would have had only to break the ground and follow the furrow. The critic of laws finds nothing more difficult than to determine justice. The labor alone would have been longer. Oh, if I had pursued this glittering prospect, and, like the man of the burning bush, with inspired countenance and deep and solemn voice, had presented myself some day with new tables, there would have been found fools to admire, boobies to applaud, and cowards to offer me the dictatorship, for, in the way of popular infatuations, nothing is impossible. But, sir, after this monument of insolence and pride, what should I have deserved in your opinion, at the tribunal of God, and in the judgment of free men? Death, sir, an eternal reprobation. I therefore spoke the truth as soon as I saw it, waiting only long enough to give it proper expression. I pointed out error in order that each might reform himself, and render his labors more useful. I announced the existence of a new political element, in order that my associates in reform, developing it in concert, might arrive more promptly at that unity of principles which alone can assure to society a better day. I expected to receive, if not from my book, at least from my commendable conduct, a small republican ovation. And, behold! Journalists denounce me, academicians curse me, political adventurers, great God, think to make themselves tolerable by protesting that they are not like me. I give the formula by which the whole social edifice may be scientifically reconstructed, and the strongest minds reproach me for being able only to destroy. The rest despise me because I am unknown. When the Essay on Property fell into the reformatory camp, some asked, who has spoken? Is it Arago? Is it Lamennais? Michel de Bourges or Garnier Pages? And when they heard the name of a new man, we do not know him, they would reply. Thus, the monopoly of thought, property in reason, oppresses the proletariat as well as the bourgeoisie. The worship of the infamous prevails even on the steps of the tabernacle. But what am I saying? May evil befall me, if I blame the poor creatures. Oh! Let us not despise those generous souls, who in the excitement of their patriotism are always prompt to identify the voice of their chiefs with the truth. Let us encourage rather their simple credulity, enlighten complacently and tenderly their precious sincerity, and reserve our shafts for those vainglorious spirits who are always admiring their genius and, in different tongues, caressing the people in order to govern them. These considerations alone oblige me to reply to the strange and superficial conclusions of the Journal du Peuple, issue of October 11, 1840, on the question of property. I leave, therefore, the journalist to address myself only to his readers. I hope that the self-love of the writer will not be offended if, in the presence of the masses, I ignore an individual. You say, proletaires of the people, for the very reason that men and things exist, there always will be men who will possess things, nothing, therefore, can destroy property. In speaking thus, you unconsciously argue exactly after the manner of M. Cousin, who always reasons from possession to property. This coincidence, however, does not surprise me. M. Cousin is a philosopher of much mind, and you, proletaires, have still more. Certainly it is honorable, even for a philosopher, to be your companion in error. Originally, the word property was synonymous with proper or individual possession. It designated each individual's special right to the use of a thing. But when this right of use, inert, if I may say so, as it was with regard to the other usufructuaries, became active and paramount, that is, when the usufructuary converted his right to personally use the thing into the right to use it by his neighbor's labor, then property changed its nature, and its idea became complex. The legists knew this very well, but instead of opposing, as they ought, this accumulation of profits, they accepted and sanctioned the whole. And as the right of farm rent necessarily implies the right of use, in other words, as the right to cultivate land by the labor of a slave supposes one's power to cultivate it himself, according to the principle that the greater includes the less, the name property was reserved to designate this double right, and that of possession was adopted to designate the right of use. Whence property came to be called the perfect right, the right of domain, the eminent right, the heroic or quiritare right in Latin, jus perfectum, jus optimum, jus quiritarium, jus domini, while possession became assimilated to farm rent. Now, that individual possession exists of right, or, better, from natural necessity, all philosophers admit, and can easily be demonstrated, but when, in imitation of M. Cousin, we assume it to be the basis of the domain of property, we fall into the sophism called sophisma amphiboli vel ambiguitatis, which consists in changing the meaning by a verbal equivocation. People often think themselves very profound, because, by the aid of expressions of extreme generality, they appear to rise to the height of absolute ideas, and thus deceive inexperienced minds. And, what is worse, this is commonly called examining abstractions. But the abstraction formed by the comparison of identical facts is one thing, while that which is deduced from different acceptations of the same term is quite another. The first gives the universal idea, the axiom, the law, the second indicates the order of generation of ideas. All our errors arise from the constant confusion of these two kinds of abstractions. In this particular, languages and philosophies are alike deficient. The less common an idiom is, and the more obscure its terms, the more prolific is it as a source of error. A philosopher is sophistical in proportion to his ignorance of any method of neutralizing this imperfection in language. If the art of correcting the errors of speech by scientific methods is ever discovered, then philosophy will have found its criterion of certainty. Now, then, the difference between property and possession being well established, and it being settled that the former, for the reasons which I have just given, must necessarily disappear, is it best, for the slight advantage of restoring an etymology, to retain the word property? My opinion is that it would be very unwise to do so, and I will tell why. I quote from the Journal du Peuple: to the legislative power belongs the right to regulate property, to prescribe the conditions of acquiring, possessing, and transmitting it. It cannot be denied that inheritance, assessment, commerce, industry, labor, and wages require the most important modifications. You wish, proletaires, to regulate property, that is, you wish to destroy it and reduce it to the right of possession. For to regulate property without the consent of the proprietors is to deny the right of domain, to associate employees with proprietors is to destroy the eminent right, to suppress or even reduce farm rent, house rent, revenue, and increase generally, is to annihilate perfect property. Why, then, while laboring with such laudable enthusiasm for the establishment of equality, should you retain an expression whose equivocal meaning will always be an obstacle in the way of your success? There you have the first reason, a wholly philosophical one, for rejecting not only the thing, but the name, property. Here now is the political, the highest reason. Every social revolution, M. Cousin will tell you, is effected only by the realization of an idea, either political, moral, or religious. When Alexander conquered Asia, his idea was to avenge Greek liberty against the insults of Oriental despotism. When Marius and Caesar overthrew the Roman patricians, their idea was to give bread to the people. When Christianity revolutionized the world, its idea was to emancipate mankind, and to substitute the worship of one god for the deities of Epicurus and Homer. When France rose in 89, her idea was liberty and equality before the law. There has been no true revolution, says M. Cousin, without its idea, so that where an idea does not exist, or even fails of a formal expression, revolution is impossible. There are mobs, conspirators, rioters, regicides. There are no revolutionists. Society, devoid of ideas, twists and tosses about, and dies in the midst of its fruitless labor. Nevertheless, you all feel that a revolution is to come, and that you alone can accomplish it. What, then, is the idea which governs you, proletaires of the 19th century, for really I cannot call you revolutionists? What do you think? What do you believe? What do you want? Be guarded in your reply. I have read faithfully your favorite journals, your most esteemed authors. I find everywhere only vain and puerile entities, nowhere do I discover an idea. I will explain the meaning of this word entite, new, without doubt, to most of you. By entite is generally understood a substance which the imagination grasps, but which is incognizable by the senses and the reason. Thus the soporific power of opium, of which Sganarelle speaks, and the peccant humors of ancient medicine, are entites. The entite is the support of those who do not wish to confess their ignorance. It is incomprehensible, or, as St. Paul says, the argumentum non apparentium. In philosophy, the entite is often only a repetition of words which add nothing to the thought. For example, when M. Pierre Leroux, who says so many excellent things, but who is too fond, in my opinion, of his Platonic formulas, assures us that the evils of humanity are due to our ignorance of life, M. Pierre Leroux utters an entite, for it is evident that if we are evil it is because we do not know how to live, but the knowledge of this fact is of no value to us. When M. Edgar Quinet declares that France suffers and declines because there is an antagonism of men and of interests, he declares an entite, for the problem is to discover the cause of this antagonism. When M. Lamennais, in thunder tones, preaches self-sacrifice and love, he proclaims two entites, for we need to know on what conditions self-sacrifice and love can spring up and exist. So also, proletaires, when you talk of liberty, progress, and the sovereignty of the people, you make of these naturally intelligible things so many entites in space, for, on the one hand, we need a new definition of liberty, since that of 89 no longer suffices, and, on the other, we must know in what direction society should proceed in order to be in progress. As for the sovereignty of the people, that is a grosser entite than the sovereignty of reason, it is the entite of entites. In fact, since sovereignty can no more be conceived of outside of the people than outside of reason, it remains to be ascertained who, among the people, shall exercise the sovereignty, and, among so many minds, which shall be the sovereigns. To say that the people should elect their representatives is to say that the people should recognize their sovereigns, which does not remove the difficulty at all. But suppose that, equal by birth, equal before the law, equal in personality, equal in social functions, you wish also to be equal in conditions. Suppose that, perceiving all the mutual relations of men, whether they produce or exchange or consume, to be relations of commutative justice, in a word, social relations. Suppose, I say, that, perceiving this, you wish to give this natural society a legal existence. And to establish the fact by law, I say that then you need a clear, positive, an exact expression of your whole idea, that is, an expression which states at once the principle, the means, and the end. And I add that that expression is association. And since the association of the human race dates, at least rightfully, from the beginning of the world, and has gradually established and perfected itself by successively divesting itself of its negative elements, slavery, nobility, despotism, aristocracy, and feudalism, I say that, to eliminate the last negation of society, to formulate the last revolutionary idea, you must change your old rallying cries, no more absolutism, no more nobility, no more slaves, into that of no more property. But I know what astonishes you, poor souls, blasted by the wind of poverty, and crushed by your patron's pride, it is equality whose consequences frighten you. How, you have said in your journal, how can we dream of a level which, being unnatural, is therefore unjust? How shall we pay the day's labor of a Cormanin or a Lamennais? Plebeians, listen. When, after the Battle of Salamis, the Athenians assembled to award the prizes for courage, after the ballots had been collected, it was found that each combatant had one vote for the first prize, and Themistocles all the votes for the second. The people of Minerva were crowned by their own hands. Truly heroic souls! All were worthy of the olive branch, since all had ventured to claim it for themselves. Antiquity praised this sublime spirit. Learn, proletaires, to esteem yourselves and to respect your dignity. You wish to be free, and you know not how to be citizens. Now, whoever says citizens necessarily says equals. If I should call myself Lamennais or Cormanin, and some journal, speaking of me, should burst forth with these hyperboles: incomparable genius, superior mind, consummate virtue, noble character. I should not like it, and should complain, first, because such eulogies are never deserved, and, second, because they furnish a bad example. But I wish, in order to reconcile you to equality, to measure for you the greatest literary personage of our century. Do not accuse me of envy, proletaires, if I, a defender of equality, estimate at their proper value talents which are universally admired, and which I, better than any one, know how to recognize. A dwarf can always measure a giant, all that he needs is a yardstick. You have seen the pretentious announcements of Elisquist D1 Philosophy, and you have admired the work on trust, for either you have not read it, or, if you have, you are incapable of judging it. Acquaint yourselves, then, with this speculation more brilliant than sound, and, while admiring the enthusiasm of the author, cease to pity those useful labors which only habit and the great number of the persons engaged in them render contemptible. I shall be brief, for, notwithstanding the importance of the subject and the genius of the author, what I have to say is of but little moment.